Hello, I'm John Baker, and I'm president of Surf Lifesaving South Australia and also the deputy national president of Surf Lifesaving Australia.
We're going to talk about your two passions, surf lifesaving and military history. Let's first of all have a look at your background. What age were you when you became interested in surf lifesaving?
Well, I'm now actually celebrating my 43rd season as an active lifesaver. So I started at the age of sort of seven as a junior or as a nipper, as we commonly refer to the young lifesavers, and been actively involved ever since, from juniors all the way through to seniors and officiating at sort of club, state, national and international level. So I've held lots of volunteer positions and been an active competitor. And now I've got my three kids involved too, which is fantastic.
Did you have anyone else in the lifesavers in your family when you were a young lad?
Not actually living, but my grandfather was a champion lifesaver in Sydney. And I grew up with stories as a very, very young sort of child. I grew up with stories and tales of my grandfather's sort of great feats in the surf as a lifesaver. So it sort of was something that I embraced and always wanted to do from a very, very young age. And my grandparents and my parents encouraged it. And it was actually my grandmother who took me down and joined me up with the Brighton Lifesaving Club, which was the closest lifesaving club to where she lived, Warradale. And it sort of started 1977, I think, was the year I joined.
Wow, good old grandma.
Yeah, she was good.
A lot has changed since that time, 1977 to now, and being involved with surf lifesaving for all of that period, you would have seen a massive change in techniques and technology in lifesaving?
Oh, it's an extraordinary change. I think there's been a huge change in terms of the makeup of lifesavers. Probably one of the most defining moments in our movement was the introduction of women in 1980. Prior to that, women could be associate members of a lifesaving club, but they couldn't be full members and they couldn't patrol. And it was actually in 1980 that they were allowed to join the movement as full participating members and patrolling members, which was probably the biggest and most positive thing we've seen in over 100 years of surf lifesaving. And we're actually now in our 113th year. We were founded in 1907 in North Bondi in Sydney. But women being allowed to join our movement was key, and we're now at the point where literally our membership is made up of 50-50 men to women, which is fantastic. And we're also seeing a big sort of cultural shift, diversity in our membership, with culturally and linguistically diverse members joining, which is starting to reflect more of our community makeup, which is really important. Technology has been a big influence, where we saw again in the 80s or late 70s the introduction of the inflatable rescue boat, which is commonly referred to as the rubber ducky or IRB. And that was one of the major changes in the way we deliver or effect rescues. And now we're starting to embrace technology around drones, which is ever increasing around the country. Drone capacity, we're looking at artificial intelligence and image recognition, everything from search patterns and techniques to jet rescue boats, jet skis, having a really profound impact on how we deliver our service and how we become more effective as a water safety organisation.
So how many of Australia's beaches does the SLS patrol?
Oh, we're literally hundreds. We've got close to 170,000 volunteer members, so we're one of the biggest volunteer organisations in the country. Of that, we'd have around 70,000 active patrolling volunteers, and we've got 400 separate entities around the country. So every surf club is its own legal entity, and there are 314 surf clubs around the country. And then on top of that, we've got jet rescue boat crews, helicopter crews, jet ski cohorts. But we'd be trolling in excess of 500 key locations around the country.
You've mentioned some very high-tech equipment there. Where do you get your funds from to purchase these items?
Well, it's a combination. We get funding from corporate partners. You know, major partners like DHL, Westpac are a key partner of ours and have been for over 40 years. Then we get significant funding from the federal government and state governments. So all of the states and the clubs are responsible for service delivery. So they're the ones that provide frontline services. So they all have individual arrangements with their state governments and then their own local sponsorships as well, which are really important. But a lot of the equipment required and needed by clubs is actually provided by clubs, and they do that with their own fundraising, membership fees, their own local partnerships with everything from butchers and bakeries to supermarkets. That's a really important part. I mean, in South Australia, state government, who have been a very, very good partner of ours have allowed us to do a lot of the great programs, but their sort of sponsorship is about 24% of our overall funding as an organisation here. So there's still a lot to be made up with, as I said, corporate partnerships and everything down to sausage sizzles at club level.
Well, I suppose a safe beach for citizens to go to is really important for any state, isn't it?
It is. I mean, because we're a beach-going community, I mean, it's part of our DNA. And while there is a large part of Australia that is inland and it is the bush, the majority of our population, of course, live by the coast. And we've always sort of, most of us have grown up with seaside visits and weekends by the beach and, you know, iconic life-saving carnivals and that sort of beach culture. So it's really important for us. And in South Australia alone, the Bureau of Statistics have recorded that we sort of get about 9.3 million visitations to South Australian beaches each year. So that's, you know, that's a lot for us to cover. And then, of course, we've got migrants who are coming into the country, and how do we prepare them for that beach culture that they wouldn't have been used to, particularly when we're getting a lot of migrants from countries that are either landlocked or, again, not water sort of based communities. How do we sort of better prepare them, and how do we get their skills up and help them, yeah, live the wonderful iconic life that we have by the beach?
Yeah, and perhaps they don't even understand what signs are saying.
Yeah, it's an important part for us. So we do a lot of work with the CALD community, a lot of work at schools and within communities around education. And as you said, just starting to understand what the dangers are around beaches, how to read signage appropriately, and the things to look for so that they can enjoy a safe day at the beach. Because even the most benign conditions can turn treacherous very, very quickly. So that's important.
Is there anywhere that citizens can look up to find what is a safe beach in their area?
Yeah, we've got a number of apps. So probably to go to the Surf Life Saving Australia website or the Surf Life Saving South Australia website. And also they can download an app called Beach Safe, which is just a really simple app that goes onto your phone, and you can type in the location of any sort of beach around the country. It'll give you a safety rating. It will also tell you where the local emergency services are. We'll give you an understanding of the beach, where safely to swim, where any particular danger areas are, if there are fixed rips or rock hazards around. So it's a great app, very, very easy to use.
And a sign of just how far technology has come, where do you see it going into the future, technology in regard to life saving?
I think in the next sort of 5 years, we'll see drones play a far greater role. And we're starting to talk now with universities about image recognition and how we can use drones to tell the difference between what is a dolphin or a shark, and how we can recognise through heat signatures where there's a high concentration of swimmers and whether that swimmer is in distress. So I think that thing's going to play a really big role in what we do. We're now starting to introduce things around tracking for our members so we can provide better monitoring and better safety for our members, where they've got the ability for us to put very simple devices on their wearable devices that will give GPS coordinates. So whether they're performing a rescue or whether they're competing in rough conditions, we can know, you know, with very, very sort of a good accuracy up to a metre on where they are if they get into trouble.
Because it's very easy to lose someone in heavy waves, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. We compete in surf conditions, and we compete in that because we need to keep our skills up to be able to effect rescues that often happen in those conditions. But we do quite often risk our lives as volunteers. And the safety of our members, obviously, is paramount. That goes without saying. But we do have to put ourselves in harm's way sometimes. But the ability to provide support and backup to our own lifesavers should they need it is something that we're all conscious of.
With that many volunteers and with that varied number of aspects of their training, who sets the training standards? Is it a standard that's set, and who does that?
Yeah, we have a national program and a national standard. So Surf Life Saving Australia is the peak body for our federation, and they're responsible for setting the standards for most of our national awards. And the great thing about being a lifesaver is that you can get your bronze medallion and you can go on patrol at Brighton Beach, or you can go on patrol at Bronte Beach in New South Wales, or all the way over to Scarborough in WA. So we have base national awards that all our members obtain, but sometimes there are slight nuances with some of the more advanced awards by state. But there is a whole curriculum that's basically delivered or set by the national body in close consultation with the states and their training and development committees.
And you're the deputy president of that national body, I understand, John.
That's right. Yes, I'm the deputy national president in my sort of fourth year in that role. And I love it. It just not only is one of the best organisations, I think, in the world as far as a humanitarian organisation, just the ability to travel and see what our members are doing around the country and some of the great initiatives is just fantastic. I'm very, very lucky, I think.
Well, I think so too, but just having that input into saving lives, incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I've been an active patrolling member now for 30 years and also a member of the Westpac Lifesaver Rescue Helicopter crew for 26 years now.
And what does that involve?
That involves being a rescue crewman or rescue diver or senior air crewman with the Westpac Lifesaver Rescue Helicopter, which has been going in South Australia since 1978. And Westpac have been a major supporter of our rescue helicopters around the country for over 40 years now and helped us pioneer helicopter rescue and coastal search and rescue in this country in many respects.
We see it flying overhead quite often, and I doubt that there are many citizens in South Australia at any rate that don't know what the Westpac rescue helicopter is doing. It's fabulous. Now, does the SLSA have any input into which beaches need their presence?
We do. I mean, we liaise very closely with councils on what beach need some sort of coverage. Not all of those beaches can afford or can accommodate a full-blown surf lifesaving club, but a number of them have lifesaving services that are provided. Quite often the emergence of new clubs, and we've had four new clubs evolve in South Australia over the last 10 years, and they're quite often driven by a community need. So the community will get together and go, look, we think we need a lifesaving service or a lifesaving club in our area, or we think the community would really benefit from having a Nipper program for the young kids. And they'll start the sort of the wheels turning from there and start to engage us and engage other volunteer organisations and local councils. But when a club does emerge, it usually comes from a real sort of drive and passion from a local community. And once they get mobile and mobilised, it's quite extraordinary to watch them collaborate, come together and bring something like that to fruition.
Which sector of our community are the most likely to drown on the beach? I know that's a rather ghoulish sort of question, but is there any particular sector of our community that's likely to have a major problem?
It may surprise a lot of people to learn that the highest risk cohort for drownings are 18 to 30-year-old men. And the reason for that is that particularly with RIPs, young men who are clearly full of bravado in many respects regard themselves as bulletproof, and they sort of charge into surf or heavy swell conditions without really understanding what the risks are, and they can find themselves in dangerous rip currents and dangerous conditions very, very quickly because of their natural tendency to embrace all things adventurous and dangerous. So it's actually 18 to 30-year-old males who are our biggest group at risk. We then obviously have that core community that we need to work very, very closely with, who are not familiar with the beaches and the ocean in many respects. So it's how do we help them understand and identify hazards and warning signs. And those are our sort of key focus.
Well, it's those 18 to 30-year-old males who also probably joined up when the call came to go and defend their country. Let's get on to that military aspect of surf lifesavers in our military. Who are some of the standout lifesavers that you have researched?
Well, there's been seven that I've had a particular interest in and have done a lot of research on with clubs and also in partnership with the Virtual War Memorial Australia, which is just an amazing online resource for anyone interested in researching their sort of family's history. But Some of the characters that sort of stood out to me, there was a young man by the name of Jack Coulter, who was a member of the Brighton Lifesaving Club in the late 30s. And Jack was a really sort of fit young man. He was a powerful swimmer, represented South Australia in two separate state teams in 1937 and 1938 in trips to Victoria. And Jack, at the very, very outset of the war, enlisted in the RAAF. And because he was a strong swimmer, he was actually assigned to Catalina Flying Boats, where he got his flying officer's qualifications and was a pilot flying Catalina Flying Boats throughout Southwest Pacific. And Jack, unfortunately, was involved in the very, very early stages of the Battle of Coral Sea in 1942. He and another Catalina were credited with actually spotting the Japanese fleet and alerting the Allies as to their sort of their whereabouts. And then they were then subsequently attacked by a number of Japanese aircraft and shot down. Now, the crew survived. They survived ditching in the Coral Sea and were picked up by a Japanese destroyer. And it's uncertain as to their fate after that, whether or not they were executed by the Japanese on board the destroyer or whether they were taken to an island and subsequently executed there, because the Japanese at that stage had a policy of executing any captured Allied flyers. So the contemporary history is that they were probably most likely taken to an island and executed. But he was one of two members of Brighton who were pilots with Catalina Flying Boats, and the other one was a bloke by the name of Coventry. Jeff Coventry was another champion swimmer and actually had come down from Port Augusta, where he had been reported in the local media as being the most likely to go to the national titles, and was a very, very good long distance swimmer. Now, he came down to Adelaide to join a business college here and went to the Unley Swimming Club, where he was recruited at the Unley Swimming Club and eventually was convinced to join Brighton. And again, represented South Australia in two state teams. Jeffrey enlisted in 1940 and became a pilot flying Catalinas again. And his story was one of great sort of courage too. He was coming back from a routine patrol when they had a distress call from an American ship which was taking on water. So they landed back in Townsville, loaded on a heavy pump, and went out to where the ship's location was. They landed in rough seas. And when we say rough seas, it was 11-foot swell that was running at the time. That's a big sea. And he landed his Catalina flying boat and they transferred the pump to the US vessel. But when they were attempting to take off, he tried to sort of find a clear path, or the clearest path he could, through the swells. And unfortunately just missed time one wave and was hit by a large wave which hit the side of the aircraft and caved in the cockpit and killed him instantly. Though the rest of the crew tried to get him out as the aircraft was sinking, they couldn't, and they all survived, but he unfortunately went down with the aircraft. So there's great stories of sort of mateship, and they all had significant roles within their surf clubs, but there's also some sort of quite tragic ends. And another member who was a member of Seacliff Surf Lifesaving Club, a gentleman by the name of Brown, Donald Brown, and he ended up going to war and served with HMAS Perth, which was subsequently sunk by the Japanese in the Battle of the Sunda Strait. He was killed during the action, where a lot of the crew who did survive went on to be captured and became prisoners of war of the Japanese in Singapore and further on the Thai Burma Railway.
You were recently involved with a virtual vigil for World War II veterans with the Virtual War Memorial. Can you talk about that?
Well, what we did, and it was a great opportunity to sort of partner with the Virtual War Memorial, which again is a South Australian initiative and now holds the records of some 600,000 Australians who had served everywhere from the Boer War through to more contemporary conflicts. But a great way for families or anyone with any interest to go online and actually contribute to the memorialisation of someone who served, so they can put up their own personal accounts, they can upload their own ephemera, so photographs, diaries, copies of medals. They can research through the site so they can find out as much information as is readily available through accredited sources about the service of that individual. But more importantly, they can build a personal profile of the stories and the details of their service. But I'm involved with that in my other sort of capacity, and I thought this is a great opportunity for two sort of great passions, life-saving and military history, to come together. And I knew that we had a number of South Australians who had served and lost their lives during World War II. And with the 75th anniversary of the ending of the Pacific War, I thought, well, what a great way to collaborate and do a week of memorialisation where we'd honour a lifesaver from a club every day who paid the supreme sacrifice during the Second World War, and allow people to find out about their stories, and in particular the clubs and their members, to understand that there are some extraordinary pieces of history that sit within their sort of membership annals, if you like.
And was that information taken up by the young as well as the old?
There was a great interest across all sort of levels of membership. And I think for younger people now, they're becoming more aware of the significant part that Australia has played in many, many conflicts over the last, 100 years. And of course, we've had some significant anniversaries with the anniversary of Gallipoli. We've had the anniversary of the ending of World War One. We've had the 75th anniversary of the ending of World War Two. And I suppose that has, in many respects, stirred their interest in Australia's involvement in those conflicts. And by also making it relevant to their passion, being surf lifesaving, I think that's allowed them to engage at a different level too, because a lot of the younger cohort, anyone from young nippers from 12 through to 16, are starting to realise that there's a connection between what they're learning at school and what's happened in their own surf clubs. So there was really, really strong interest. And the clubs now are becoming more sort of conscious of the need to, I think, remember and give context to the experience of those members, whether it's through sharing posts that we did on Facebook or actually starting to get their own memorial and honour boards.
Is there a memorial board anywhere for lifesavers?
At Coogee Beach, there's a national memorial, which that was probably launched about 6 or 7 years ago, and that's actually a memorial to all fallen lifesavers from around the country. That's a lovely statue at Coogee Beach. There was a book that was written by a member called Stan Vesper, which is simply called Those Who Served, and that details the nominal role of all those lifesavers that we know of who served around the country. But a lot of clubs now have their own sort of honour boards, and they're starting to put up photographs of members who have served and in some cases sort of made that ultimate sacrifice. So there's a higher consciousness, I think, now circulating within clubs, which is terrific.
That is good. We've talked about World War II, but what about contemporary veterans? We have veterans overseas as we speak. Are some of those lifesavers?
Yeah, there are. We've got a strong contemporary veteran community, from those who are still serving and serving overseas to those that have transitioned out of the ADF and into civilian life, becoming members of lifesaving clubs. We've got a number of senior members of Surf Lifesaving South Australia who have served in the regular Army and regular Air Force and Navy. They're quite humble. They've done some extraordinary things, but they're, as far as they're concerned, they're just volunteers again and they're members of their surf club. So it's trying to actually unearth some of those stories is important, I think, too. But quite often they don't see themselves as veterans as such. It was a professional career that they did. They acquitted themselves and now they're just members of a surf club. So sometimes they're a bit reticent to share their stories. But it is, again, it's another part of the sort of marvellous fabric of surf lifesaving clubs that we should really be conscious of and I think respect and understand.
When I was a little girl, I was saved by a lifesaver at Scarborough Beach, so I might not be here today if it hadn't been for him.
It's actually quite extraordinary. The amount of people who have either been involved in lifesaving or have been affected by lifesaving or, as you said, owe their lives arguably to an action by a lifesaver is quite extraordinary. There's not too many people that you need to speak to without finding some connection. In fact, I was talking to one of our MPs in Canberra 6 or 8 months ago, and he said, oh, yes, I was saved by a lifesaver when I was only a young lad. I'm sure I would have drowned had it not been for that person. So there again, the effect that we have, and in South Australia last year we saved 167 lives.
Wow.
On our beaches, which is extraordinary. Just to think what the roll-on effect would be if we hadn't have been there.
Telling me. What's next for John Baker and the Virtual War Memorial? Do you have a project in mind?
Well, the Virtual War Memorial, it continues to sort of grow. As I said, we've now got around 600,000 records. But what we really need is, I think we need to get sort of more formal government recognition and support. It's an amazing project. Nothing else like it in this country. In fact, nothing else like it worldwide, I don't really think. And of course, we can say that quite confidently. But I think the more South Australians that get online and use it, and the more they contribute, the bigger it becomes. And for us, we're looking importantly for how we expand our schools program, which is an important part of what we do here in South Australia. We want to look at expanding that nationally and getting some sort of support from government and corporate partners to realise the value of what we've created.
Mm. Well done to the Surf Life Saving Association and to the Virtual War Memorial. And thank you, John, for coming in today and talking about both with Service Voices. We look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Pleasure. Good to talk to you. Thanks, Helen.